What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm producer Catherine Hughes. On this episode of the podcast, we're joined by model and actress Emily Ratajkowski. She first shot to fame after appearing in the music video for the controversial song Blurred Lines, which then led to a number of modeling contracts and acting roles. In 2021, Ratajkowski published a collection of essays titled My Body. This memoir explores the fraught relationship between feminism, capitalism, and exploitation, which she discusses in this conversation with broadcaster Samira Ahmed. This episode is part of our series, How I Found My Voice, hosted by Samira Ahmed. If you like this episode, do check out the entire series. The recording for this episode took place in September 2021.
It felt very exciting to be sexualized as a young girl because I had understood that women, powerful women, were often the sexiest and the most beautiful, whether that be Britney Spears or actresses or other models. So for me, at that point, it felt exciting and I liked it. I think we use the word industry really lightly. I think it's like, oh, the industry, but we don't talk about what's being traded in the industry, and that is women's bodies. I don't believe in good and bad men, but I do think that the kind of concept of, you know, oh, this guy is a bad one and this one's a good one. Oh, but he has kids, you know, like this game that we end up playing in the media and within ourselves online, all those places is incorrect.
Hello and welcome to How I Found My Voice. I'm Samira Ahmed and I go behind the celebrity persona to find out what influences shape their success. How did politicians, artists and performers grow up to become such great and unique communicators? My guest today is from a world that is usually thought to be about image and not voice. Emily Ratajkowski is a model and actor who's been on the covers of many magazines, featured in films such as Gone Girl and in a pop video, Blurred Lines by Robin Thicke. She wrote a widely read essay, Buying Myself Back, in 2020. Which revealed a powerful voice willing to speak up about the challenges of how her image was used and commodified by others. She's now written a book, My Body, about her life, and it's something of a whistleblowing insight into the world of young models. Emily, welcome to How I Found My Voice. And
thank
I should
so
say,
much.
First of all, we're delighted to claim you as a Londoner, as I gather you were born here, but California is where you grew up.
Yes, that's right.
Can you describe mini Emily, what she was like? What did she want to be?
I think... sort of the same. Very much interested in performing, very like to talk to people. But, you know, of course, I can't remember being a child. This is what I've heard from my parents.
And growing up in California rather than in London, I'm sure it must have shaped the direction your life took and your career. Did you ever imagine what might have been the choices you'd have made if you'd stayed in London?
You know, my parents aren't English. My mom was teaching in London when I was born, and I did move back when I was four. My mother did another year of teaching English Lit in the UK. So I do love London, but I don't I wouldn't say that I know it well enough to have that sort of insight.
So what sort of home life did you have? Can you tell me a bit about your parents and the environment in which you were growing up?
Yeah, my mom is a retired English professor. My dad is a painter, a high school painting teacher. We lived in a pretty small house that my dad built himself in San Diego, California. Definitely the stereotypes of California beach culture were a huge part of my existence and my childhood, but also sort of the academic, artistic, political conversations my parents were interested in having were hugely impactful to me.
What sort of conversations were those?
I mean, my parents definitely always believed in sitting down for dinner. And, you know, I'm in New York. I live in Tribeca. And it's the 20th anniversary of September 11th. And I was remembering that I was 10 years old and, you know, talking about it with other people. I was aware that I was so politically engaged. I already knew, you know, had all these opinions about George W. Bush, all that sort of stuff at the age of 10. So I was just very much involved in those conversations as a child with my parents.
Now, you were signed to be a model at 14, which suggests that your family were aware of your looks, scouts were spotting you. Can you give me a sense of when you became aware that the way you looked was potentially going to be a way to make a career?
Yeah, so I write about this in the book a little bit. My parents... you know, we'd get stopped, various different people, sometimes not connected to the industry, would say to my parents, you know, this is a really great way for a kid to make money. And you want your child to pay for college, you're worried about paying for college, like, let her model. And I became really involved with theater, a local children's theater, and I loved it. And we met some people through sort of my acting classes and that community who had started to do commercials. And these parents were saying to my parents, well, we put a down payment. She could put a down payment for a house down because she was in this Coca-Cola commercial, you know, hitting a soccer ball. And I think at that point, my parents said, well, we can't deny our child this opportunity. And that's how I started modeling.
Can you remember your early modeling jobs? Any particular ones that stand out for you?
Definitely. I was doing a lot of teen magazines were the first shoots, and it was extremely exciting and very nerve-wracking. I remember my eyebrows got over-tweezed on one set.
They grew back at that age, though.
Thank God.
And, you know, you'll know, I mean, I can remember reading about the early careers of models like Naomi Campbell, who was discovered as a young teenager. There's always this anxiety about very young girls when you're still in adolescence, selling a kind of sexuality in modelling. What did you feel about the way that you were treated, the way that the clothes that you were wearing? I mean, how did that affect your forming sense of yourself as a young woman?
I had developed breasts very early. So even when I was signed at 14, it wasn't because I was a traditional fashion model. I did have curves. And I would say that it wasn't just the modeling. It was also just the way the world works and what our culture teaches us, that it felt very exciting to be sexualized as a young girl, because I had understood that women, powerful women, were often the sexiest and the most beautiful, whether that be Britney Spears or actresses or other models. So for me, at that point, it felt exciting and I liked it.
And can I ask about your parents' involvement in this stage? Because they obviously supported you, but I think your mother in particular had kind of ideas about beauty and the importance of it. Can you tell me a bit about that?
I have a son, but at one point I wanted a little girl and I had to sort of think about what that was going to be like. I had an ex-boyfriend's mother say to me that if she had a daughter, she'd want to discuss with her, you know, staying thin. And I was horrified when she said that. But as I've gotten older and even in the process of writing this book, I realized that was her way of trying to protect her daughter. I think that there's a reality to the fact that women are treated a certain way based on the way they look. And my mother was aware of that. And in her childhood, it had been discouraged for her to capitalize on her looks and certainly her sex appeal. And I don't think she wanted that for me, but it also meant that we probably placed a lot of import and value in the way that modeling could make me feel about how I looked.
You did seriously consider acting. You mentioned having done youth theatre. Tell me about how you came to pick modeling over acting at that early stage in your teenage years.
I didn't really. I mean, I think that modeling was much easier for me to stay in high school, and I didn't want to be tutored. I wanted to stay in school. And if you're a working actor, you have to leave school because you're working 12-hour days on sets. That being said, I felt like modeling was easier. It made more money. It just was sort of a thing that I came towards. And then once I started to really model a lot, I all of a sudden had this hurdle in the acting world of being considered a model turned actress or a model actress, which came with its own baggage.
What, there was a kind of snobbery, a discrimination, you think?
Absolutely. I think that there was a sort of thing of, well, like, you're pretty, but do you have any talent? Is there anything more than that? Which I definitely internalized. It's something I write about in the book. And it made me feel worse and worse about myself to go to these auditions and feel very insecure about my abilities as really just anything, not even just as an actress, but just as a person, because I felt like my worth and my value was in the way I looked.
There's a point in the book when I think your parents' marriage is in a tough place, and you talk about the house being a place with no boundaries. And this was to do with being an only child and seeing into the silences. Can you tell me a bit about what you meant and how that has shaped you as you've grown up?
I think that definitely I was an only child. My parents were very much, you know, we still kind of, my dad jokes, like the Three Musketeers. There wasn't a parent-child dynamic in the way that a lot of families have when there are other children. My parents included me in their relationship. And I think it made me, only in writing the book did I realize that that sort of laid a groundwork for me not knowing what was crossing a boundary or what privacy and space was, or me even really being able to put words to my desires, like what I want. Asserting those felt almost rude sometimes.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared.
It's interesting you talk about, you know, something feeling rude. Rose McGowan was the first person I interviewed for this podcast, and she said we are raising girls to be polite and it is killing us. And reading your book, I just felt so shocked at how, from the outside, it looked like, you know, you were beautiful and powerful, that there would be a power that came with being a well-known model. But actually, you're repeatedly treated in a shocking way, including little things like being expected to undress in front of clients, that there's a power game involved. How much of these realizations have come to you in recent years, and how much do you think you knew at the time?
I think I didn't know any of it at the time. Not that I didn't allow myself to think about things, because allowing implies that there was some kind of decision-making. I just simply didn't think about the experiences where I was treated less than. And I chose instead to focus on the very real power, you know, which is comes with making a lot of money, which comes with fame, that felt like, well, see, it was evidence to the power that I felt I had accrued. And it seemed to me that taking a harder look at these things would have been maybe ungrateful, and also really fundamentally humiliating for me to talk about the ways that I had been disrespected physically or emotionally.
One of the things that you do write about is being sexually assaulted as a teenager. You write about it with great calm, an incredibly dignified way. When did you start to name your experience for what it was?
I think the first time I ever talked to someone about it was one of my girlfriends, and she was really the person who said, and I write about this, that sounds like rape. And my first reaction was, absolutely not. What are you saying? But my physical reaction, what I felt in my body was, oh, you're totally right. And that's when I realized that's how violations manifest often. Your mind says one thing and your body tells you something else. I don't think until I wrote this essay I actually even read some review recently that said she was sexually assaulted and stalked. And I thought, oh, right, that is stalking.
We should say this was a high school boyfriend, wasn't it?
Yeah. And these essays weren't written with me thinking, I'm going to write about my sexual assault and stalking experience. It was quite the opposite. It was like, I'm going to write about this experience I have all the shame about, to try to figure out what the truth is to this experience. And only now, I mean, I wrote that essay probably 3+ years ago, am I starting to realize, oh, wow, it was this and that. So that's sort of the beauty in writing.
Well, you've actually answered You've answered my next question, but I'll ask it anyway, because you've explained the beauty in writing that and what why it was valuable. Because there's a worry that women since Me Too are required to relive their trauma again and again for others by sharing their stories. And, you know, people wonder, you know, is it worth writing about it? And as I say, you've kind of explained why. It was partly for you to process it, but also about putting the truth on the record, I guess.
Yeah, I do think that women's experiences are very inconvenient often to the status quo. And I think that we are trained, I'm not sure if it's about to be polite or whatever, but we're trained to sort of deny our experiences because they're fussy. And, you know, I write about it even a couple of years ago, being at a party and feeling like if I just wasn't the one who is in this equation, then everything would be fine. Actually, just my existence is the problem, not the way people act towards me. That being said, I don't think that every woman needs to decide that she needs to publish a book about her stories or name names. I think it's, again, putting too much of the onus on women to carry the responsibility. I have found that it's been personally very liberating.
You were 21 when you appeared nude on the cover of the sort of autistic erotica magazine Treats, which led to your appearance in the 2013 Blurred Lines video. Robin Thicke saw the magazine and requested you. And of course, that video propelled you to kind of global fame. You start the book with a chapter on Blurred Lines and the making of it. And I wonder whether you just felt conscious that for many people, that may have been the first time they fully became aware of you. And it was to some extent where your story starts in the public imagination.
Definitely.
It caused a storm at the time, even before we knew from reading about your experience of making it, because the whole premise of the video seemed to many onlookers to show a predatory contempt for women. Even though you were having a lot of fun making it, you were paid well. How do you look at that video now?
I think it's really complicated. I think that it's the thing that brought me my career in many ways. And there's just a truth to that. I think that, you know, it was the starting point, and that's the important thing about the book. And one of the things I want to stress while I'm doing press, that there's nuance to this. It's not, oh, you are disempowered if you're a body. It's complicated. You're both rewarded, and you also will have experiences that are dehumanizing at the same time. Both those things coexist. And that's how I feel about that video.
There's so much emerging now about how models over the last couple of decades have been preyed on by bosses, by clients. And I'm struck by you're a kind of whistleblower on the industry, and you write about parties where, you know, very rich businessmen would pay to book models like you to turn up with them at sporting events and parties. What made you want to sort of expose that now?
Well, I think we use the word industry really lightly. I think it's like, oh, the industry. But we don't talk about what's being traded in the industry, and that is women's bodies. And so I think writing that essay in particular, which is titled Transactions, was in hope to sort of show all the types of transactions, not just the way it's just your image, but it's also your presence and how much it is based on powerful men who have money making decisions about women.
How old were you when you started being, you know, invited to events like this with other models?
You know, in that piece, I write about being not being paid, but, you know, being invited to go to dinners in LA when I was 19, 18, where you're fed, party promoters set up these events. They're paid by wealthy men to have nights out where they offer meals, which entices girls who aren't making very much money, probably new to New York or LA, to come out. And, you know, then afterwards you go to the clubs with these really wealthy men. And that started happening basically as soon as I moved to Los Angeles, so after high school.
And at this stage, you know, how far were you talking to your parents about some of these situations, and what advice were they giving?
Oh, I don't know that I was talking to them about these situations. I think that, you know, like so many young people, I definitely wanted to feel autonomous. I wanted to feel independent. I felt like my whole life was starting. And that was also one of the reasons I would go out to these things, because I had this sort of romanticized vision of a young person, you know, going to New York City or going to Los Angeles and going out and meeting a really cool group of people. And that was like totally the opposite of what was happening. Even now, I talked to my husband or to different people about their experience, and men specifically going out, and it's so different than what a young woman experiences. It's not this sort of like, oh my God, the whole world is open to me. It's terrifying.
And, you know, you and, you know, fellow models that you knew in the business, how did you talk to each other about some of these offers and some of these experiences? Did you kind of give each other warnings? You know, how did it work?
I don't think enough conversations are happening between women in these situations. And I think that's part of the issue. I didn't even know the first time that I went out to one of these meals with a party promoter that that's what was happening, even though other girls had invited me, friends that I'd made at castings. So it wasn't until, you know, I was like, why is this guy always texting me, inviting me to go out every Thursday night, that I figured out the dynamic that was what was actually going on. There wasn't enough of sort of looking out for each other. I think that there was so much shame around what women were doing. And also we're so, you know, a lot of us were so young, and women aren't now girls going out to these situations. They don't know, they don't have the wisdom to share.
Has anything changed, do you think, since you started modeling for the new generation coming in?
I don't know, because I'm in a different position than I was 10 years ago. So I don't want to speak to that. That being said, I've, you know, been at enough nightclubs, you know, I don't go to them frequently, but where I've seen very clearly the same thing that I'm writing about, 18-year-old girls with men who've made arrangements for them to be there with them.
What was the tipping point for you into when you felt in more control and that you weren't in these situations where you felt uncomfortable or that you'd been somehow ambushed into a situation you didn't fully understand? When did that end and why?
The more sort of successful I became and the more power I had in these situations, I don't think I would be groped and grabbed at in the same way that I was. That being said, only a couple of years ago, I was on a shoot and the male model's like hand slipped down lower than it should have been. And, you know, I let the client know that I didn't appreciate it. And there was a conversation with him, but then we took another picture and I was on set. You know, I was working.
Being professional.
Yeah, it's considered being professional. And I think that that's definitely something that models, and I think all women for sure, are taught, but the agencies really stress is, you know, this is your job. You have to go there. And you don't get to have boundaries because you've signed up for this. That's what being a model is. So I don't know that it's changed all that much. I think now people are afraid of being canceled. And I don't think that that is how real change occurs.
Do you mean men are afraid of being canceled?
Men, but also clients, people who are producers of shoots, whatever. They want to be, you know, politically correct, not because they actually believe that there's anything on the line other than consequences for them. And as somebody who's a new parent, I haven't had to think about teaching my child these sort of things yet. He's only 6 months old. That being said, I do think that I've learned that you can't teach a child an idea by letting them be afraid of making them afraid of the consequences. You need them to understand, don't hit your sibling because it hurts your sibling, not because you're going to get a timeout. And that's how I feel on a larger scale. We are macro way with where we are with this kind of thing after post Me Too. I think that people are just operating out of fear rather than understanding of concepts.
I wanted to ask about 2017, when you were arrested at a Washington, D.C. protest against the nomination of the Supreme Court Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who, of course, his teenage behavior and his alleged sexual assault was brought up. When did you decide to go out and put yourself on the line on issues like that and why?
I felt so personally angry when I read news like that this was going to be our next Supreme Court judge who had, you know, very, all these women, you know, were talking about things that he had done. And it felt so disrespectful that we would be giving somebody who had hurt women in this way such an honorary title. And I was so angry. It wasn't really a decision of, oh, I'm going to put myself out there. It just felt like I had a personal vendetta. I had a personal feeling that compelled me to work on these things.
You wrote this essay, and I remember reading it back in New York Magazine in 2020, called Buying Myself Back. It went viral. It's become the magazine's most read piece of the year, about consent and control. And you were sued by a paparazzo for reposting a photo of yourself, as well as, I think you stated that the photographer, Jonathan, later sexually assaulted you. Can you just sum up, from your point of view, what was the heart of that story? And again, why you wanted to put it out there on the record?
That essay is really about image and control. And the experiences that I weave together in that essay are examples of when I have felt like I could either take back control or have control or power through my image being used and out there in the world and commodified, and how often that is not the case.
For those who might go on to read the essay, could you just sort of explain briefly what was the image at the heart of it and how it came to be in dispute?
So there's three different examples. There's a paparazzi who sues me for an image. There's a Richard Prince painting, Instagram painting, quote unquote, that uses one of my Instagrams. And then there was a photographer who shot me nude and published a book of those Polaroids without my permission.
It's fascinating because the image of you is, people think of, well, you know, you make money by letting people take your image. It was fascinating to realize it was much more complicated, and the sense of the loss of ownership of your identity you had through those three examples. How disturbing was it for you? I mean, you know, people from the outside look and they think, you know, you're this beautiful, successful, wealthy woman. Why was this so distressing? They might not understand.
I don't know how to explain what a violation feels like. I can tell you what the emotional toll and physical toll it took on me. I just recommend people read the essay.
Issues around people's imagery being used without consent is something that affects so many people around the world. You mentioned earlier that you are a mum, and congratulations on your son. There is another issue there, which you've hinted at, which is the whole issue of raising boys, because that's the other side of your whole life experience, isn't it? What was going on with the way some of these men behaved, whether it was taking a liberty on a video shoot? Or I think about all the women who were involved in shooting that Blurred Lines video. I had no idea. It was almost entirely women on the production side behind the camera. But you're being assaulted on the set, and somehow not one of those women was actually in the end able to stand up and truly challenge what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, this is a perfect example of, we could say, oh, those women, somebody should have taken responsibility. I actually don't believe that. I think that it's just the power dynamic overall that was at play at the shoot. Nobody was in a position to do so. And the same thing with Robin Thicke. Like, I don't believe in good and bad men. I don't think that is real. I think that we have a world where men are able to sometimes unknowingly benefit or take advantage of their position in the world. Sometimes it's malicious and they are aware. But I do think that the kind of concept of, you know, oh, this guy is a bad one and this one's a good one. Oh, but he has kids, you know, like this game that we end up playing in the media and within ourselves online, all those places, is incorrect. I think what I want to try to stress is that it's the culture that we live in. So what I'm hoping to teach my son isn't like, don't do this or don't do that. It's like having empathy and understanding for how the world works. Just like when you're talking about race, it's similar to that.
How optimistic are you that the next generation is being raised better when it comes to these issues? It's a bit early for your son, but, you know, even just with friends and children.
It's really hard because I think that these things are passed on to us and they're reinforced time and time again in ways that we don't have control over as a parent. I know that. So you can have one sort of conversation at home, but then there's going to be everything else in the world impacting him in a different way. So I don't know if I'm hopeful or not. I'm just, I feel aware of the landscape, which is a difficult one.
You may know it was in the news quite recently that research from, I think Facebook owns Instagram now, don't they? And that they had kind of kept secret research on Instagram. And in the UK, we've had evidence from the education watchdog here, Ofsted, about young girls in particular suffering worse and worse mental health linked to online body image and the impact of spending a lot of time on some of these apps. It's a part of your business to use Instagram to show yourself wearing clothes that you know you're selling. How do you regard that whole relationship between those kinds of online apps and what they're doing to our young women in particular?
I think that it's always been, there's always been things that have been influencing women and telling them what they should look like and their bodies. I experienced it pre-Instagram myself. I think, again, the best thing we can do is teach women and try to sort of change the overall system rather than say to our daughters, who of course are going to want to know what it feels like to be considered hot because the world rewards that. So I don't think that we should be shaming the women who want to experience that or experiment with that, because there is power to be gained from it monetarily and otherwise. That being said, if we can talk more about why that's not great and why that's so unfair to women in particular, there's hope there.
How do you reconcile the two? Because you'll know so many people will see a fundamental contradiction in living off a carefully curated online image and, you know, your push for honesty. And so it's all very well for you to say.
Well, because I think that that's what I'm trying to do. I mean, I think that's why I wrote this book. I could have not written this book. It's very difficult to be honest online, because it's the same way that a tweet is very different than writing an essay. Or if you ask me about what it feels like to have these experiences with image being taken from me, I wouldn't be able to tell you. That's why I wrote the essay, right? Because I think that there is something lost in these mediums of Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. TikTok might be a little better, but it's still, you know, it's just a little tiny second. And so my hope is to move towards nuance and to tell the truth. You know, it's the same thing with when I think about, you know, I campaigned for Bernie Sanders and people said to me, well, if you're anti-capitalist, then how can you, you know, live in a world where you're making money? It's like, well, that's the world we live in, right? So I'm going to take advantage of the system that's there and I'm going to survive.
And pay your taxes.
And also just, you know, survive, but also succeed. So that's the reality of it. And I, again, it's the same sort of thing with the canceling. I feel like the way that we try to pick people apart and say, you know, well, you can't do that and that. You can't believe, you know, that Bernie Sanders should be taxing billionaires and also want to make money. It's not fair.
What do you see yourself doing over the next few years? Because it feels like you're moving into new territory.
I mean, I don't know. I want to see what happens with this book, what the response of publishing my story is like. I'm scared. I'm nervous because it was such an incredibly cathartic, healing experience to write it. And I'm not sure if publishing it will be the same way. So I hope that coming out of this, I will want to write more. Maybe it'll be fiction instead of nonfiction personal essays, just in a way to sort of protect myself. But I'd like to work on projects where I can tell stories that feel impactful and I can be in as much control as possible.
Have you thought about going into politics yourself?
I talk about something I feel cynical about. The political system is brutal and the way politics work are quite brutal, but maybe.
Given the honesty with which you've exposed a lot of wrongdoing in the past, have you already had any responses from people who were witnesses, who were there, kind of coming forward with, I don't know, apologies, admissions, new information?
Not yet. I did have the director from the music video was fact checked, and she said to me, well, don't you remember I said, like, we can stop the shoot, which was so interesting to me because I don't remember her saying that, which, you know, doesn't mean that she didn't say it, but it's an empty offer. It was an empty offer. We couldn't have stopped the shoot.
You're waiting to see what response the book gets. You have chosen to use your voice to tell incredibly personal stories. What would you say to anyone who might be listening to this, who's read the book, who perhaps has experienced something along similar lines in terms of sexual assault? What would be your advice to them about using their own voice and going forward?
I think it's a personal decision whether or not they want to put their stories in the world. I hope that by doing so myself, that they'll learn to digest their own experience in a way that eradicates shame. It doesn't have to be a book you publish, but I do think telling your story, even just to someone that you are close to and trust, can be the only way to move past it.
Emily Ratajkowski, thank you so much. This podcast was made by Intelligence Squared. The producer was Farah Jassat. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please do subscribe. Tell your friends and your family to check it out. And we'd really appreciate it if you could also take a very quick moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. This helps us to raise the profile of the podcast and it helps other people to find the show.